Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. None of them are previewing what is likely to be a Donald Trump romp in all five states in the Mid-Atlantic and Northeast. Today, Jim, there's one good martini aspect of this. This isn't our actual good martini, but one good silver lining of the fact that the primary will soon be over in Maryland, and that's that you and I don't have to listen to radio ads from Democratic congressional candidates trying to outdo each other on who wants to ban guns and facilitate abortion more.
Yeah, you know, remember how, like, there was a time, for, you know, that Democrats had learned their lesson on this issue, and they were going to moderate their tone, and, you know, Jim Webb represented this new era of Democrats who are not at war with the Second Amendment. Remember those times, Greg?
Yeah, good times. Yeah, well, that's over now. But guns is playing into our real good martini today. This is courtesy of Hot Air, but also the underlying information from Harper Polling. According to a new survey conducted by Harper Polling, 72% of Americans agree with what's known as the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act. Basically, there's a push that Hillary Clinton has now got on board with, as well as many other knee-jerk liberals that want to make gun makers liable in court for crimes carried out with the guns that were sold lawfully. So it's somehow on the gun makers rather than the people actually getting the guns legally and then following their insane instincts and going out and killing people. So, Jim, this is an issue that the Democrats are somehow hoping would be good for them. But this new survey from Harper shows that nearly three quarters of Americans are absolutely opposed to this idea. And if Hillary Clinton thinks going against the guns, meaning gun owners and gun makers, is a good idea this year, that could be a major backfire for her.
You know, Greg, after the O.J. Simpson trial, did Ron Goldman's family sue the knife maker?
Nope.
Right? I mean, ultimately, it was not the knife that did the I guess it was, the knife did the damage, but the fact that it was being held by O.J. Simpson, oh, yes, he was acquitted. Let's all pretend.
Allegedly.
You know. Allegedly, you know. If someone runs someone over with their car, do you sue the car maker? You know, if somebody gets beaten with a baseball bat, do you take a lawsuit against the Louisville Slugger Company? Right? I mean, the idea is that the objects do these terrible things instead of the people who are using those objects. And, it kind of merges this three-way goal for the left. One, obviously, is to prevent Americans from owning firearms and make it harder for them to buy them. Two, it's a backdoor way of banning an industry without actually passing a law. We're just going to sue them out of existence. And three, this, I think, really insidious mentality in American life that if I suffer a tragedy, someone owes me money. This kind of frivolous lawsuit, this idea, we all remember the infamous story of the woman who spilled hot coffee at McDonald's and sued for $1 million and things like that. This idea that if you're running around, if something bad happens to you, well, by golly, it's somebody else's fault and they have to pay, and you're entitled to a giant settlement. And it's good to see the American people kind of rejecting this philosophy. It's not a lot of times we see a large majority on our side, but it's kind of good to see that this idea of transitive responsibility has not caught on anywhere near as much as Hillary Clinton and her allies would like.
The story goes on to point out that Pew Research does a broader question on the Second Amendment, and the report there from Pew was that for the most part in the 1990s and the subsequent decade, a substantial majority of Americans believed it was more important to control gun ownership than to protect gun owners' rights. But in December 2014, the balance of opinion flipped for the first time. More Americans say that protecting gun rights is more important than controlling gun ownership, 52% to 46%. So the American people have made their opinions on this issue very, very clear. And the fact that the Democrats are tone deaf on it is also very good news.
It's not surprising news, but it's good news.
Yes. And Hillary's been very transparent about this. And of course, your favorite, very favorite Hillary surrogate, Chelsea Clinton, last week going out and saying that Justice Scalia was the one hanging up gun control decisions from the Supreme Court. So once my mom's in office, we can get a definitive decision on gun control in America. So just remember that, everybody. All right, on to the bad martini now. And as odious as the idea of a Hillary Clinton presidency is, let's talk a little bit about the one who's currently holding the office. Barack Obama's been overseas for the past few days and getting very little coverage. I'm sure he's representing American exceptionalism everywhere he goes, from Britain to Saudi Arabia and beyond. He was in Germany, I believe this was yesterday, Jim, speaking to young people and talking about why he believes that this is just a grand old time to be alive. Here's a couple different clips.
We are fortunate to be living in the most peaceful, most prosperous, most progressive era in human history. That may surprise young people who are watching TV or looking at your phones, and it seems like only bad news comes through every day. But consider that it's been decades since the last war between major powers. If you had to choose a moment in time to be born, any time in human history, and you didn't know ahead of time what nationality you were, or what gender, or what your economic status might be, you choose today.
A couple different things to point out there, Jim. Once again, he apparently believes that there's no immediate existential threat. Things are hunky-dory. And he's going back, I guess since he's in Germany, it makes sense, to the global citizen approach of, well, education and healthcare are improving in general across the globe. But if you ask Americans about their thoughts over the past 7 years, I don't think they're too thrilled with this moment in American history.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, just we could take the Middle East just for example. I think you can say that the Middle East has never been less stable. Certainly, we've seen terrible terrorist groups before, but we haven't seen them controlling wide swaths of territory like ISIS does. I think we can safely say that Iraq is of dubious stability. I think we can safely say that Saudi Arabia and Yemen feel more threatened. I think Iran looks strongest, and we haven't even gotten, you know, to North Africa, and the collapse of the Libyan regime, the flood of migrants coming across Europe. I mean, he really makes like, you know, you're all just a bunch of gloomy gusses, America. You know, you got to keep looking on the bright side. Things are getting better. Now, look, if he says, which decade would you like to be born in? Greg, I'll admit I'm a fan of the medical advances we have today. Our phones are neat. Oh, no, yes, there are things in life that are going well. But I think if you look on particularly the era of peace and prosperity, no, this is not a peaceful era. This is not a prosperous era. You know, we have Russia and China aggressively on the march. And if you bother to look beyond, you know, you start look at this and you start wondering, what's in the PDB that he gets every morning? And why does it not match up with what we're seeing in the global world news section of any newspaper, if you bother to pay attention beyond our borders? It's a dangerous, threatening world, and it just kind of feels like the president's in flat-out denial here. Not exactly new from him, but it just seems particularly overt that he is absolutely insisting that who are we going to believe, him or our lying eyes?
Well, he's right that it's probably the most progressive era, or at least aggressively progressive era,
capital P, yes,
in a very long time, yes, in terms of progressive liberal politics. I don't know that I'd want to be born today. I think you and I were born in an era that is just about ideal. We still get to take advantage of the modern technologies that you referenced, but we also kind of got through public education and some other areas of life before the PC crowd really hit in. There's no safe spaces. And I think growing up before we had a phone attached to our hand is a little bit of an advantage, in some ways perhaps a disadvantage. But just understanding the way things were before everything was digital, I think is good.
Yeah. Obama likes to insist the arc of history bends towards justice, which is accurate, but it bends that way because people bend it that way. You know, it doesn't just happen. You know, like, oh, you know, and then we lucked into victory over the Nazis, and then we lucked into progress, and things just happen again. No, you have to fight to make them get better. And Obama kind of seems to, you know, look, he's coming. He knows he's coming to the end of his presidency, and he wants to write the story of the happy ending. The problem is the facts aren't holding up to it, and most Americans kind of don't feel that way. And so he kind of increasingly turns like, we've done the metaphor of Chip Diller at the end of Animal House, insisting all is well. This is, you know, this is the president insisting you've never had it so good, even though Americans don't feel that way. So.
Yes, and I have had it better. All right, on to the crazy martini now. And while it will be a very good night for Donald Trump tonight, and we'll find out in terms of delegates just how good when the results pour in tonight, there is not all sunshine and roses in the Trump campaign. Ken Vogel and Eli Stokols for Politico today writing, Donald Trump is bristling at efforts to implement a more conventional presidential campaign strategy and has expressed misgivings about the political guru behind them, Paul Manafort, for overstepping his bounds. Trump became upset last week when he learned from media reports that Manafort privately told Republican leaders that the billionaire reality TV star was, quote, projecting an image, unquote, for voters and would begin toning down his rhetoric, according to the sources. They also said that Trump expressed concern about Manafort bringing several former lobbying colleagues into the campaign. They're also upset that he convinced Trump to give up tons of free TV time and doing fewer TV interviews while Manafort goes out there, and some think he's just trying to resurrect his own political career. As you cite in the Jolt today, Jim, the article goes on to say, after Trump's resounding victory in last week's New York primary, Manafort handed the candidate a speech he'd written for him and aimed for a more presidential tone. Trump took a quick look at it and told Manafort he'd consider using such a speech down the road, but in the glow of his huge win in his home state, he still preferred to wing it. And I'm guessing, Jim, he was still winging it just a tad yesterday when he decided to go after John Kasich's eating style during a stop in Rhode Island.
Kasich, I don't think he knows what, you know, did you see him? He has a news conference all the time when he's eating. I have never seen a human being eat in such a disgusting fashion. I'm always telling my young son, Barron, I'm saying, and I always with my kids, all of them, I'd say, children, small little bites, small. This guy takes a pancake and he's shoving it in his mouth. It's disgusting. Do you want that for your president?
I'm guessing that wasn't on the teleprompter, Jim. And as the story says, looks like Corey Lewandowski is getting back a little bit of power as this struggle inside the campaign goes on.
Yeah, I mean, it's not unheard of for there to be disagreements at high levels of presidential campaigns. These are high-stress environments. People are going to disagree about the right approach. But what's weird about this is it almost sounds like Trump and Manafort never really had a discussion before he was hired about how the campaign should operate and what style. Manafort is in the RNC meeting selling that you're going to see a new Trump. This is a pivot point. We're going to the tone of the campaign is going to change. We've done what we needed to do in one stage. Now we're going to go to a different stage. And apparently Trump either never got that memo or he looked at that memo and said, no, I don't want to do that. I kind of feel like Manafort is going to be like Sisyphus because Trump is who he is. There's not really much. He's a 69-year-old man. He's not likely to turn on a dime and completely change his style. And even if he did, I think a good portion of the people who support Donald Trump would feel pretty betrayed. They'd probably say, wait a minute, what is this, you know, button-down, polite, soft-spoken Trump? This is not the guy we voted for. This is not the guy we wanted to elect. Now, when you look at Manafort, you know, if he says he's going to be more presidential, then the next day Trump goes on this diatribe about John Kasich's eating habits. But you notice how it's, you know, it's always Little Marco, it's Lion Ted, low-energy Jeb, that Trump just kind of like latches onto some aspect of someone. Greg, before yesterday, had you ever thought about John Kasich's eating habits and the size of his bites?
Never.
Right? And now, every time John Kasich has any type of, I bet this may be the last time John Kasich eats in public ever again. Right? I mean, it's very weird. There's something very like schoolyard bullyish in that he finds something about the person that annoys them, or that they can just kind of stick to him. And in the Trump base, that's all that defines this person. The only thing you need to know about John Kasich could have the best policies in the whole wide world, and he doesn't. But even if he did, it doesn't matter because he's a messy eater, you know. It's just this bizarre, it's not like it's not just that Trump mixes the personal attack with the political attack. I don't even think Trump really knows what John Kasich stands for. He just kind of blurs it in together there. We skip past that, and so there's this strange phenomenon there. Is this what Paul Manafort signed on for? I mean, would you want to be the campaign manager if you write up this memo and here's how it should be, and the candidate says, nah, I'm going to go keep doing what I'm doing? I'm sure at some point, Paul, in the not-too-distant future, Paul Manafort is going to ask, why am I here? And what's just kind of baffling is that even for, you know, as a passionate Trump critic and a guy who looks at Manafort with a level of distrust for his work on the Ukraine, they seem smart enough that they would have talked this out before, so it'd be very bizarre to see how this shakes out between the two of them. It's hard to see. Look, there can only be one vision on the campaign, and at some point, if Manafort's vision conflicts enough with Trump, you got to wonder if Manafort's going to stick around.
Well, it'll be very interesting, but Trump is so loyal to his guys. He's always been so loyal. That's the lesson from Corey, but I think Trump just basically feels like this is working now, and every time he talks about John Kasich eating or the delegate process being rigged, we're not talking about actual policy or presidential qualifications, and where the race stands right now, at least prior to the nomination, that can only help him, I think.
I was going to say, Donald Trump wakes up every morning and decides what we're going to be talking about. And I don't just mean you and I on the show. I mean, like, what the American news cycle is going to be about. That's, you know, one of the disturbing lessons of 2016, and we will see if the media can shake up. I noticed that last night they're still covering the Trump rallies live on CNN. So, you know, Cruz doesn't get that, Kasich doesn't get that, but the network's not playing favorites at all. Right, Greg?
No, not in the least. So, Jim, I know you're off tomorrow. Talk to you Thursday.
See you Thursday, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today, and be sure to tune in again on Wednesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.